Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Screen Talk, IndieWire's weekly movie podcast, coming to you from our apartment in Cannes. It's me, Eric Cohn, the executive editor and chief critic, with Ann Thompson sitting just less than 2 feet away from me, so we're close to the mic, and how exciting is that? We have been in person to do this podcast in recent times in a rooftop in Tribeca, but it's got nothing on the experience of being back here. How are you feeling about it, Ann?
We are so happy to be here, and by the way, true confessions, Eric and I have had a few glasses of wine.
Okay, I had half a glass of red because I was pressured.
I had two glasses of rosé, but it was Someone pressured me. It was Terry Fremont.
Yeah, it wasn't Anne. It was the head of the festival, and it was for a toast. And because we're toasting a lot this year, just being at this festival was fascinating because a couple of weeks ago, it felt like a hypothetical. It was like hard to really see the scale and complexity of a festival that's known for not just the volume of people here, but the complexity of being able to navigate it, working in these times that are known for distancing. But 2 days and some change into it, it seems to be working. And what I've enjoyed about it is that we're seeing a lot of movies. We're seeing some good ones, some okay ones, all that kind of stuff. But overall, the sense is that everybody's ready to get back to business and make it work. And that kind of positivity is a reinforcement of why these kinds of events still matter. So
it needs to, the mechanism needs to get back up and running. And yeah, this is really the most important festival in that sense.
So everybody's here.
We have buyers here. We have distributors.
It's quieter, but it's the usual
about
game.
It's half as many people as usual. And it's hotter. It's summer. So there's a sort of summer vacation vibe.
And tourists are around. Yeah. You know,
but it's not the big crowds at all. And the theaters are kind of empty. Not empty, but half full. I was at the Todd Haynes movie, which is probably my favorite movie so far, Velvet Underground, last night at the late night Lumiere screening, and the ushers were trying to get us to move to the center to sort of fill in some of the empty seats just for the visuals.
But we don't want to give the impression that the Lumiere seems super empty. I mean,
well, that's the biggest theater.
Yeah, it's hard to fill it sometimes.
But it's sort of nice. It means there's empty seats around, and our core group of, it's like the families reunited.
Yeah.
You know, the film community family. Yeah. And we went to a party afterwards last night, and there was Matt Dentler from Apple, who was very proud of his first film.
Yeah, it was the first time that the Apple logo was on a Cannes screen. And it was funny because this now no longer off the record joke that Thierry Frémaux made at the Cannes dinner, right? He said that, you know, we're celebrating the 120th year of cinema, or it's 125th, one of those. It's hard to discern exactly where the anniversary starts there. But then he said maybe one day we'll celebrate the 125th anniversary of Netflix.
And then he got all flummoxed as the journalists
he said,
were ripping
off,
out their
off.
Phones.
But it's out there, so we're not breaking the embargo.
Yeah.
But the thing that's, he then sat down at the table I was at and canvassed the table. He said, so what do you think? Are we going to do the Netflix? He was very proud of that joke. And I said, Netflix, why not Apple? Because it's true. The streamers are here. Amazon had the opening night film with Annette. Amazon has Val, the documentary. They have the Asghar Farhadi film. So it's not like streamers are out of the conversation.
And the only reason Netflix isn't here, I mean, Five Bloods was supposed to debut here with Spike last year, but it, of course, Cannes didn't happen. That was going to be out of competition, and it was fine. Everybody went along with it. Spike was going to be the jury president. This time, it was Jane Campion's movie that couldn't go out of competition. And why would you want a Jane Campion movie? She's the only woman filmmaker to win the Palme d'Or. There's two women actresses who shared blue as the warmest color, whatever.
Yeah.
But she's the only director to win it. And you're asking her to to take her movie and put it out of competition? I don't think so.
You know, I always enjoy the first thing that I observed at Cannes when I first came here is what a big deal competition is.
It is.
People come out of a movie. It's but there's nowhere else on earth, no other festival or curated event where people come out of the experience and they say, that shouldn't have been in competition or that should have been a competition film. And I love the debates about that. This year they added a section called Cannes Premiere, right? And they put some filmmakers in it who have been at the festival before.
Who they would ordinarily be catering to by putting them, they're criticized for this all the time.
Yeah.
Putting the same old auteurs into the competition and taking slots away from new filmmakers. So this is a good direction.
But I also think it's doing something else too, which is the reality is, generally speaking, the films they want in competition feel like bigger films. Like not bigger in the, like a production sense, but they're making a big statement, as opposed to say, let's say Andrea Arnold, right? She has this movie Cow. It's a documentary. So she has always been a competition filmmaker, but her films, it's like American Honey, a very robust film, as opposed to Cow, which is a very, you know, quiet, small documentary about the life of a cow. I loved it, but to put that in competition, it might seem a bit strange in the context of the kind of noisiness that they want competition films to deliver. So it is fascinating.
So Oliver Stone is in that section.
Yeah.
And
Cornel Mundrusco has a film called Evolution there that's sort of based on play.
So maybe these are movies that are quieter. And by the way, I'm not as high. I think that Cow is a very good movie, very, very riveting in its way. It takes you behind the life of a cow that, you know, you see them as you drive by standing.
But you've never
seen
them.
But you don't see the whole life, the la vie entière.
You never see them in post-coital embrace.
No, well, that was cool, yeah.
It was
so
gorgeous.
You see the whole thing. But it follows Gunda. I'm sorry. It follows Gunda.
I thought Gunda was great, but I don't think that the Gunda super fandom necessarily needs to take away from the greatness of Cow. Like, there's room for multiple documentaries about the lives of animals that are on their terms.
But Gunda was much more interesting in the way it was done.
I think that they're very different movies in terms of the way that they're done. Gunda sort of hovers around the life of many different farm animals in a way that is
mostly
sort of like
the sow, mostly the mother.
But is there a narrative arc to that?
Who is being separated from her piglets.
That's the last scene of the movie, spoiler alert, but is there a narrative arc to Gunda?
The narrative arc to Gunda is the same narrative arc as Cow.
Cow has, I think, more, because you're actually watching this animal grow up.
But you know exactly where it's
born.
Going to end.
You see it born, and you see something at the end that completes that cycle, so... You know, it felt a little bit more of an evolution to me. But in any case, we'll see what happens. It's an acquisition title. It could get out there.
And the point is that there's some strong documentaries here.
Yeah.
The story of film update called A New Generation by Mark Cousins is
technically
excellent.
The opening film.
It opened the festival, in effect. And the reason for that was that Terry Frimo thought that it had it was made during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And it offered a kind of transition from the pandemic.
Yeah. It was a good sort of starting statement because what I enjoyed about the story of film A New Generation is that it's sort of like a summation of my festival experience of the past 10 years. Like, he gets, like, every film in there. It's like, there's Ari Aster, there's The Souvenir, you know, then he talks about Black Panther. I mean, it's like literally, if you were on a retreat for the past decade and hadn't seen any movies, you could catch up pretty well this way. So that's a good sort of public service, whether or not it's a great movie.
If you've never met Mark Cousins, he's a genial and delightful Irishman who lives in Scotland.
And his voiceover is very soothing.
And I love listening to his voice. I just do. It's like you're sharing, the screen with him. And he's very much in the present tense as you look at the movie. The other good movie, as we discussed, is Velvet Underground.
I keep saying it's just a great New York movie. Todd Haynes did something really amazing there where he took all this footage and he created these split screens that are very Warholian in a way, but also have a kind of avant-garde tradition to them. And so you're like looking at, you know, Lou Reed's face on the same screen that you're, you know, seeing footage from, you know, some other source, and you're hearing voiceovers of different people, and it's a good overview.
It's actually
overview.
Very complex. He interviews John Cale. That's the central interview because, of course, Lou Reed is gone.
And the drummer, too.
Yeah, and she's great.
I didn't realize she's the one who sings, the close the door.
And then Nico isn't in it. And,
of course.
But
you hear her voice a little bit.
But the real connection with Andy Warhol is detailed, and there's some old factory girls. One of them, surprisingly, is Amy Taubin of the Film Society.
I didn't know that Amy Taubin has a legacy in that. I mean, she has a Warhol screen test that I have seen before in another context. But she's a great voice in this movie to talk about what people don't always want to admit with the nostalgia.
Which is that the Factory Girls was a diminutive name to apply to the women.
And the factory was pretty sexist overall.
And Mary Warnoff is great in it, too. And John Waters.
Here's what I appreciate about it. I don't think it's a perfect movie, and I think the ending's a little rushed in terms of what happened towards the end.
Well,
there,
they skip over
but
some things.
They do, and especially the falling out that Lou Reed had with Andy Warhol is not really detailed, but I will say that I think because it's an Apple documentary now, they were selling this off of footage at Cannes in 2019. But now that it's coming to Apple, there's so many people who like have a passing understanding of what Velvet Underground is, what that band represented, or they know like one or two songs. This is a great way to sort of bring people up to speed on the overall sort of evolution of their creativity and why they were such an important band in terms of reflecting so many other things going on.
Well, that's the point.
Creatively.
It captures a period of time that was very rich and very creative. And I think Haynes was the perfect person to do it. And he did it in a very innovative, fun way. It's a lot of fun.
And it's not the only movie that has some pretty wild footage, although I will say it's the best one to have Jonas Mekas footage in it. Because Jonas Mekas, this was the last interview he really did. He was interviewed he was like 96 years old when he did this.
Credit to Christine Vachon, the producer, and of course, Todd Haynes' old, long-term producing partner. She said, Todd, get him now. And that was the first interview they did.
Yeah, I mean, he was a guy who was like always had his video camera around, or his film camera and then his video camera. So I feel like on some level, there's probably a lot of what he captured that drives this movie, and it's a great tribute to him. But there's also Val Kilmer, who had been capturing footage for decades, and we should talk about Val, a movie that it's authorized. He has a producing credit on it, but
I would say authorized is a very quote unquote. In other words, it's really Val Kilmer's vision of his own life. Edited and directed by other people who are executing his wishes and his family's wishes. This is very much of a reach for redemption on his part.
Well, here's what I actually quite enjoyed about this movie is that because he had been filming himself for so long and it was never quite clear what he was trying to capture, he captured a side of the sort of irony behind being an actor in Hollywood, this idea that you're going to go out there and change the world with your convictions about performance, and then when you get big roles, those roles can't accommodate whatever you want to do. Like when he's playing Batman or whatever, he's on the set for Red Planet trying to explain why the director is not in sync with his ideas, or probably the best moment when he's on the Island of Dr. Moreau set yelling at John Frankenheimer and trying to explain to him that he can't act because he doesn't know if John Frankenheimer's going to quit the project. I think you get some insight into a process that we almost never see. So whether or not it is authorized, it is, I think, a fascinating window into that side of the business.
I agree with you. This is a rare look at an actor from his point of view, no holds barred in some ways. But there are, it's still filtered because people who knew him, and I mean, there's a lot left out. There, he was ill, so we learn about that. We learn about his family.
He can't really talk now.
We don't know what happened with Joanne Whaley, his wife.
Right, he doesn't want to get into
love.
It.
Yeah. There's some other stuff that's completely left out.
But I mean,
he was
it
a
is
Scientologist.
A Christian scientist.
You told me this.
Yeah, he wrote his memoir, and part of the reason why he got into that situation was because he didn't get proper health care. But I also think that the thing about his situation where he lost the ability to speak is that it has forced him to be more reflective about how he didn't quite realize his potential as an actor. And it's a first-person movie. He narrates it. His son reads his voiceover. And so it's okay for it to be his perspective because it's told in his voice.
I wish he had been the one directing it. You know, well, taken
he's
the
never
credit
directed
for
a movie.
It,
I mean, he wanted to direct a movie about Mark Twain. It never happened. That's in the movie.
So, yeah. Now, you like this movie a lot. You give this movie more credit than I do. It's well made. I'm not saying Ben Cotner, a very respected documentarian, is the producer of this movie. And it's as good as it could be under these conditions.
And it's coming to Amazon. And I think people are going to be fascinated by it. You know, he's got that nostalgia factor.
It actually makes people respond to the family side of the story.
Exactly.
So
let's double back because we haven't talked about opening night and we haven't talked about some of the other movies that we've seen in the high profile section. So Annette, crazy ass Sparks musical, Adam Driver jumping around playing, I don't know,
naked.
Like Gigi Allen or something like that. It's a wild performance. He's giving head while he sings a love song. And it's, I'm a Leos Carax fan, obviously, and we get a movie from him like once a decade. And I was super into the sort of chaotic swings of this rock opera movie. I also was... It was obvious to me as soon as I saw it how much it was going to divide people. And the division around this movie, I think, has been really fun to follow because it's not like a Lars von Trier thing at Cannes.
It is a little bit.
I haven't felt that. I haven't felt like rage. I felt some people who were saying it didn't quite work. And then there are other people who are really passionate about the vision that's driving it. And I like that divide.
I would give Lars von Trier more credit for being in control of whatever tone of craziness he wants.
He's more exacting.
In any of his movies.
Yeah.
He knows exactly what he's doing.
And he wants to push buttons in a more explicit way.
This is all over the place. This is meandering. The tone
is not. Didn't you enjoy that opening song?
Of course I did.
Everybody loves
the earworm. The opening song is great. There's a lot of great stuff in it. The actors are really good. I mean, you have to give Adam Driver credit, and any actor who sees this movie will, for how fearless he is, how brave he is. And he pulls it off to a great degree. But then how do you come to terms with a director making such basic wrong decisions? I'm sorry, very poor creative decisions about how he puts together an ocean wreck sequence where a murder takes place, how he handles the baby, which is, he didn't want CG, he didn't want puppets.
Oh, I really like that.
Animatronic puppets.
I love that.
So he has this crazy thing that because he wants the actors to actually embrace this child who has to sing on a big stage, and so there he talked himself. I could see what he did. He talked himself into a corner of what he couldn't do, and then all he thought he was left with, where I think other directors would have understood that some blend of CG and reality would have worked better.
No, I think the wooden baby is so effective because of exactly what you're talking about. It's very strange artifice for a movie that's all about someone completely trapped in his own reality. That is what that movie, and I don't want to spoil the last scene, but the last scene is the ultimate wake-up call about what happens when that reality ends and somebody realizes how badly they've screwed up. It's a movie that people, I think, will come back to and talk about. And again, an Amazon movie that people will watch because of Adam Driver.
And will be the last of its kind.
But I think, but I was
going to
just say,
it's the last gasp of the Ted Hope.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Period.
It would be nice
and
if they leaned into this, but they won't.
We're going to see anything like that coming out of there again. But the point is, yeah, they got their opening night. They got their movie stars on the red carpet. Adam Driver flew in and flew out because he was working on White Noise.
He didn't even do the press conference. But he did light up a cigarette during the standing ovation, which was about a real power move on opening night. So we got that. We've seen a couple competition
movies.
It's not
an Oscar contender. Hello.
Well, what about original song? So may we start? The best earworm of the year so far.
That is a catchy
song. And Edgar Wright made that documentary about the Sparks brothers. They're sort of
now
in the zeitgeist.
Yeah. But the music is very repetitive.
It's
really not that good. I'm sorry.
I can't wait to continue to argue about this movie when it comes out later this summer. But another movie coming out later this summer is Stillwater, which I don't think we're going to be doing a lot of arguing about because it's not that kind of movie. It's not like something that's going to generate a lot of conversation in general, but it brought Matt Damon back to the red carpet with Tom McCarthy in a very I think, stable drama overall.
I used the word solid.
Solid,
so
yeah.
Stable and solid are not, you know...
too dissimilar.
They're not effusive
no.
praise. So this is one of those movies that's really good and quite dramatic, and you jump into it and you want to know what's going to happen, and Matt Damon gives a great performance as this Oklahoma everyman.
Yeah, it's
who's
one
sort
of those...
a fuck up who's trying to redeem himself.
Well, it's one of those risky performances where at first you're like, he's doing
stupid,
the poverty porn thing.
Yeah.
But I realized about halfway through, I was like, okay, now I actually buy him as this character. And the plot is pretty compelling early on because he's got this daughter who's in jail in France and he's trying to get her out and doing all these things that she doesn't know about that are very dangerous. I thought sort of halfway through it got a little messy in terms of some of the plot twists, and he goes to a certain extreme that I didn't totally buy.
Well, the daughter at one point says that he is incapable of not fucking up, and so is she. And that's actually the center of the movie, I think.
Yeah. I mean, Abigail Breslin plays the daughter. We do get to hear her speak French quite a bit, which after hearing Jodie Foster at the opening ceremony speak French,
she's
like, all right,
so
it's catching
beautiful.
On. Everybody's
she's so
doing
beautiful,
it.
Jodie.
All these American actors want to impress the Europeans. But I thought she was maybe not totally convincing in this role, Abigail Breslin.
She was good.
I had some mixed feelings about her.
She was obviously a troubled kid. And you know, he had been an alcoholic and he was trying to clean up his act. And he was growing as a person. That's what I liked most about
yeah.
it. It's about how being in another culture, in a strange culture, can open your eyes and open your heart. And change you. And I thought that was the most optimistic thing about the movie.
So that'll come out, and I guess, you know, Damon sells a movie. It's the kind of film where it's like, it's not for everyone, but it's very accessible. I mean, there are non-movie buffs I could show it to. And
here's
would,
the thing.
They would
this,
be okay with
in
it.
In the pre-pandemic world, I could imagine this made focus features. So they have the ability to go wide. They have the ability to go platform with an art film. They have the ability to push an Oscar campaign if they want to. This is coming out in July, which is not conventional Oscar time. It is, you're using Cannes as a launch pad for this movie, and it makes sense because it played really well here.
Yeah.
And I would say that they could have had a big theatrical between the coasts kind of theatricals, I mean,
yeah.
really successful movie.
Yeah.
And now I don't know what happens to this movie.
It's a fascinating question.
It could be a weird, it could go well. I could see people really liking it.
As we're recording, we haven't seen the range of reviews.
Right.
And then there'll be another wave of reviews when it comes out. I don't expect them all to be huge raves, so... That's a challenge because it is sort of a movie that would need a lot of enthusiasm around it. It's nice to have a strong Matt Damon performance to go see, and the story is somewhat compelling. It's not a thriller, but it's almost like something like that in the sense that you can have sort of it's very engaging. It's not like a passive sort of depressing movie. Yeah, yeah. It is
Tom
engaging.
Tom McCarthy's a good writer and a good director.
It's certainly his best directing
it's
since Camille Spotlight.
Camille Cotin from Call My Agent.
Yeah, yeah, your favorite show. So, as
no,
we're...
But honestly, Matt Damon gives an Oscar-worthy performance. It's just that I don't know if it survives the onslaught of material that's coming this fall.
So as we're recording, we're actually really early on in the festival, and a lot can change. That's the fascinating thing. It's like when we convene next week to record, we could be talking about so many different movies. The competition has barely gotten started, but it's a fascinating jury. Spike Lee, who was chosen last year, finally gets to be the head. He's the first African-American director of the jury, but also he's Spike Lee, and I think he's an awesome choice because we know that, you know, this is a guy who makes movies in all these different registers, but he also is a cinephile, and he's got very engaged kinds of sensibilities, but he's surrounded by other really fascinating directors like Kleber Mendoza Filho, who had Bacurau here just a couple years ago, and... what's her name? The Atlantic's director, Maddie Diop.
You can tell that they're already bonding.
These are really amazing, risky directors. Maggie Gyllenhaal, who started directing stuff.
Yeah.
She's also a real serious kind of viewer
of Inglourious Basterds fame.
Yeah, sometimes I feel like there you could slip in somebody in the jury who might be, you know, impressive on paper, but their sensibilities might be at odds with people, and that can throw off the rhythm. But I think in this particular case, what you're going to see is that there's going to be some really complex choices made, and that makes it super unpredictable, because every juror member gets one vote, and they're going to watch two movies a day for 10 days.
But remember that there are more actors and more women on this jury than ever before, Tahar Rahim. So the women,
Melanie and Laurence,
and the actors tend to lean into emotion. This is just my observation over the years. So we shall see.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, as we're recording, we haven't seen a lot of these competition films yet. I mean, Annette was a competition film, but there's a lot more to come. We've got Paul Verhoeven's Benedetta. We've got, you know, Sean Penn's Flag Day. I did see Ahed's Knee from Nadav Lapid, who won Berlin with his last film, Synonyms. Fascinating, angry film about a Israeli filmmaker sort of struggling with his feelings about censorship and military service and so forth, but not for all tastes. Obviously, it's a fascinating watch, but it's a one that I have to assume will incite a lot of different reactions. Joachim Trier's film from Norway, The Worst Person in the World. He is a revered director who makes these very layered kind of dramedies about, you know, creative young people. That's a film that I think could be a kind of quote unquote consensus film. And I feel like we're going to start looking for those sort of access points as we continue to talk about the Palm contenders.
Still to come is Bergman Island,
Mia Hansen
French
Love.
Dispatch, Benedetta, the
Red
Verhoeven
Rocket
film.
From Sean Baker.
Yeah.
So Titane from Julia DeCorno, who did Raw. That looks nuts. We got The Nanny Moretti, Trey Piani. Francois Ozon, people seem to really like his new movie, although we haven't seen it. And then Asghar Farhadi is always seems to be appreciated.
Always good.
So that, and even a pitch upon Weir Sathakul, whose name even you can pronounce now because he's so popular. So, and those films, some of those are screening really late in the festival. So usually, I mean, I used to think when they're late in the festival, it was like, that's a value judgment. But the truth is, you really don't know this year because everything came together so last minute. It could be that someone's not totally done, or it could be for some other reason, like they just don't have enough space to show all these movies at the start of the festival.
Well, the other thing that's fascinating this year is that because of the timing of Cannes in July, you have someone like Eugene Hernandez from the New York Film Festival basically just finishing up his programming. I mean, he has to go back to New York and announce
right
away. And so that's going to be interesting. What will their opening night and the Centerpiece Gala and closing night be? What are they going to... They usually pick up quite a few films from Cannes. So what will happen? And then we're right into the fall festivals.
And
we still don't know what's going on. I mean, Venice has had a sort of lucky streak of being spared, you know, the grim realities of the COVID virus. They got away with it last year, and they did it again.
Yeah.
And somehow poor Toronto has been the opposite.
They're at the mercy of the situation with the border, Ontario quarantining, and all that stuff. And so a lot of people here have been asking questions about that. They're wondering, so what is the deal with Toronto? Telluride is going to be a big deal. You know, there's all these expectations, and I think it's going to be fascinating to see how they evolve, because as we've all learned in the past year, you can't make any assumptions about 3-4 months down the line.
I'm also hearing that the once genial and friendly relationship between Telluride and Venice has devolved into something more competitive.
I mean, the thing is,
about
when you
the
have
talent.
Yeah, I have no doubt about that. I haven't heard that until you said it, but it makes sense, because if you think about it, these festivals have different kinds of values in play. As nice as it is to think about everyone working together, that's just not really festival strategizing doesn't make that easy, especially if you're happening at the same time and part of your values derive from the kind of media attention that you get. So people want to have the first premiere of X, Y, and Z. So how do you find common ground there?
They used to be able to work out it because Telluride would say, we're not having a world premiere. We're not playing that game. And then they would say, we'll work it out so that we're debuting at exactly the same time as you are in Venice.
They well, have they'll ways call it a surprise screening or whatever. Yeah. Oh, like yeah. Something like that.
But I'm sorry to hear that's devolving.
Yeah, it's too bad. I do think that people should stop being so obsessed with those things. Like the year that New York Film Festival opened with The Favorite after it had already played at a bunch of other places, they sold out and they got good press and it was fine because it was a great movie and everyone was happy with it. And frankly, just because Cannes, you know, or one of these festivals is like timed in a certain way and wants to have these movies when they're ready to launch in a certain kind of way, it does not mean that that has to rub off on everyone else. The world premiere game is probably the worst thing for film, for festival culture. It's just that there's no easy solution to it right now, especially when we have so many people who just want to come back in a big kind of way. So the chaos will continue and on. And next week, we'll have a chance to talk more about all this stuff because, as I said earlier, we're going to see so many other movies and it's just so unpredictable. And I just have to say, I'm just so glad that we're here. We're in a new apartment. We got a lot of space. We got air conditioning. In spite of all the complexities, we're spitting into tubes every 2 days, but somehow it kind of feels like it's working. And, you know, if people are still quarantined, maybe in different parts of the world or whatever, you know, I hope that everyone's staying safe. But I will say that it does feel to me like we're moving in a really positive direction in terms of the world that we left behind. And it feels like it's really starting to happen now.
The other thing we can talk about next week, because I've been doing some interviews with the distributors who are here, and they are, at least to me, presenting a very united, optimistic front about the return to theaters.
Yeah. Of course, when these movies that they're presenting come out,
we'll see.
So TBD. Well, Anne, let's go to some parties and I'll cut you off if you have too many.
I'm the one who cut you off tonight.
On the record.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.